He returned a moment later, cradling three heavy leather-bound tomes that smelled of age and some spicy alchemical preservative.
"Velanetta," he said as he settled the books on his lap. "You are familiar with her? No? She was the foremost scholar of the last flowering. There are only 6 sets of her work in all the world, as far as I know. Most of these pages are on sculpture, painting, music, alchemy. But there are fine passages on furniture, gems worth mining. If you please."
They spent half an hour poring over the sketches Locke had provided and the pages Beaumondaine wished to show him. Together they hammered out an agreeable compromise on the design of the chairs that Master Fairwhite would receive. Beaumondaine fetched a stylus of his own and scrawled notes in an illegible chicken scratch. Locke had never before considered how many details might go into something as straightforward as a chair. By the time they had finished their discussion of legs, bracings, cushion fillings, leathers, scrollwork, and joinery, Locke's brain was in full revolt.
"Excellent, Master Beaumondaine, excellent," is nonetheless what he said. "The very thing, in sheer crescent, lacquered black, with gold leaf to gild the incised decorations and the rivets. They must look as though they had been plucked from Emperor Talathri's court just yesterday, new and unburnt."
"Ah," said the carpenter, "a delicate subject arises then. Without meaning to give the slightest offence, I must make it clear that these will never pass for originals. They will be exact reconstructions of the style, perfect facsimiles of a quality to match any furnishings in the world, but an expert could tell. They are few and far between, but such a one would never confuse a brilliant reconstruction for even a modest original. They have had centuries to weather. These will be plainly new."
"I take your meaning, Master Beaumondaine. Never fear. I am ordering these for eccentric purposes, not for deceptive ones. These chairs will never be alleged to be originals, on my word. And the man who will receive them is such an expert, in fact."
"Very good, then, very good. Is there anything else?"
"Yes," said Locke, who had withheld 2 sketch-covered sheets of parchment and passed them over. "Now that we've settled on a design for the suite of chairs, this, or something very much like it, subject to your more expert adjustments, must be included in the plans." As Beaumondaine absorbed the implications of the sketches, his eyebrows rose steadily, until it seemed that they were being drawn up to the fullest possible extent of his forehead's suppleness, and must be flung back down to the floor like crossbow bolts when they reached their zenith.
"This is a prodigious curiosity," he said at last. "A very strange thing to incorporate. I'm not at all sure..."
"It is essential," said Locke. "That, or something very much like it, within the bounds of your own discretion. It is absolutely necessary. My master simply will not place an order for the chairs unless these features are built into them. Cost is no object."
"It's possible," said the carpenter, after a few seconds of further contemplation. "Possible, with some adjustment to these designs. I believe I see your intention, but I can improve upon this scheme. Must, if the chairs are to function as chairs. May I ask why this is necessary?"
"My master is a dear old fellow, but as you must have gathered, quite eccentric and morbidly afraid of fire. He fears to be trapped in his study or his library tower by flames. Surely you can see how these mechanisms might help set his mind at ease."
"I suppose I can,"
muttered Beaumondaine, his puzzled reluctance turning to interest in a professional challenge as he spoke. After that, it was merely a matter of haggling, however politely, over finer and finer details, until Locke was finally able to coax a suggested price out of Beaumondaine.
"What coin would you wish to settle in, Master Fairwhite?"
"I presumed solari would be convenient." Shall we say 6 solari per chair?
Beaumondaine spoke with feigned nonchalance. That was a cheeky initial offer, even for luxury craftsmanship. Locke would be expected to haggle it down. Instead, he smiled and nodded. If 6 per chair is what you require, then 6 you will have.
Oh,
said Beaumondaine, almost too surprised to be pleased.
Oh, well then, I should be only too happy to accept your note.
While that would be fine in ordinary circumstances, let's do something more convenient for both of us. Locke reached inside the satchel and drew out a coin purse, from which he counted 24 gold solari onto the little coffee table, while Beaumondaine watched with growing excitement.
There you are, in advance. I prefer to carry hard coinage when I come to Salon Corbeau. This little city needs a moneylender. Well, thank you, Master Fairwhite, thank you. I didn't expect... Well, let me get a work order and some papers for you to take with you, and we'll be set.
Now, let me ask, do you have all the materials you need for my master's order?
Oh, yes, I know that off the top of my head.
Warehoused here at your shop?
Yes, indeed, Master Fairwhite.
About how long might I expect the construction to take?
Given my other duties and your requirements, 6 weeks, possibly 7. Will you be returning for them yourself, or will we need to arrange shipping?
In that, too, I was hoping for something a little more convenient.
Ah, well, you have been so very civil, I'm sure I could shift my schedule. 5 weeks, perhaps?
Master Beaumondaine, if you and your daughters were to work on my master's order more or less exclusively, starting this afternoon at your best possible speed, how long then would you say it might take?
Oh, Master Fairwhite, you must understand, I have other orders pending for clients of some standing, significant people, if you take my meaning.
Locke set 4 more gold coins atop the coffee table.
Master Fairwhite, be reasonable. These are just chairs. I will bend every effort to finishing your order as fast as possible, but I cannot simply displace my existing clients or their pieces.
Locke set 4 more coins down next to the previous pile.
Master Fairwhite, please! We would give you our exclusive efforts for far less, if only we didn't already have clients to satisfy. How could I possibly explain this to them?
Locke set 6 more coins directly in the middle of the 2 stacks of 4, building a little tower. What is that now, Beaumondaine? 40 solari, when you were so pleased to get just 24?
Sir, please, my sole consideration is that clients who place their orders before your master's must, in all courtesy, have precedence.
Locke sighed and dumped 10 more solari onto the coffee table, upsetting his little tower and emptying the purse. You can have a shortage of materials, some essential wood or oil or leather. You need to send away for it. 6 days to Talvera and 6 days back. Surely it's happened before. Surely you can explain.
Oh, but the aggravation! They'll be so annoyed!
Locke drew a second coin purse from his satchel and held it poised like a dagger in the air before him. Refund some of their money. Here, have more of mine. He shook out even more coins haphazardly. The clink, clink, clink of metal falling upon metal echoed in the foyer.
Master Fairwhite, said the carpenter, who are you?
A man who's dead serious about chairs. Locke dropped the half-full purse atop the pile of gold next to the coffee pot. 100 solari, even. Put off your other appointments, set aside your other jobs, make your excuses and your refunds. How long would it take?
Perhaps a week,
said Beaumondaine in a defeated whisper. Then you agree? "Until my 4 chairs are finished, this is the Fair White Furniture Shop? I have more gold in the Villa Verdante's strongbox. You will have to kill me to stop forcing it upon you if you say no. So do we have a deal?"
"Gods help us both! Yes!"
"Then shake on it. You get carving, and I'll start wasting time back at my inn. Send messengers if you need me to inspect anything. I'll stay until you're finished." 4. As you can see, my hands are empty, and it is unthinkable that anything should be concealed within the sleeves of such a finely tailored tunic. Locke stood before the full-length mirror in his suite at the Villa Verdante, wearing nothing but his breeches and a light tunic of fine silk. The cuffs of the tunic were drawn away from his wrists, and he stared intently at his own reflection. "It would, of course, be impossible for me to produce a deck of cards from thin air. But what's this?" He moved his right hand toward the mirror with a flourish, and a deck of cards slipped clumsily out of it, coming apart in a fluttering mess as it fell to the floor.
"Oh, fucking hell," Locke muttered.
He had a week of empty time on his hands, and his legerdemain was improving with torturous slowness. Locke soon turned his attention to the curious institution at the heart of Salon Corbeau, the reason so many idle rich made pilgrimage to the place, and the reason so many desperate and downtrodden ate their carriage dust as they trudged to the same destination. They called it the Amusement War. Lady Selgeska's stadium was a miniature of the legendary Stadia Ultra of Therimpel, complete with 12 marble idols of the gods gracing the exterior in high stone niches. Ravens perched on their divine heads and shoulders, cawing half-heartedly down at the bustling crowd around the gates. As he made his way through the tumult, Locke noted every species of attendant known to man. There were physicians clucking over the elderly, litter-bearers hauling the infirm or the unabashedly lazy, musicians and jugglers, guards, translators, and dozens of men and women waving fans or hoisting wide silk parasols, looking like nothing so much as fragile human-sized mushrooms as they chased their patrons under the growing morning sun. While it was said that the floor of the Imperial Arena had been too wide for even the strongest archer to send an arrow across, the floor of Selgeska's recreation was just 50 yards in diameter. There were no common seats. The smooth stone walls rose 20 feet above the smooth stone floor, and were topped with luxury galleries whose cloth sunscreens flapped gently in the breeze. 3 times per day, Lady Selgeska's liveried guards would open the public gates to the better class of Salon Corbeau's visitors. There was a single standing gallery, which even had a decent view, to which admission was free. But the vast majority of spectators at the stadium would take nothing less than the luxury seats and boxes, which needed to be reserved at some considerable expense. Unfashionable as it was, Locke elected to stand for his first visit to the Amusement War. A relative nonentity like Mordavi Fairwhite had no reputation to protect. On the floor of the arena was a gleaming grid of black and white marble squares, each 1 yard on a side. The squares were set 20 by 20, like a gigantic catch-the-duke board. Where little carved pieces of wood or ivory were used in that game, Selgeska's playing field featured living pieces. The poor and destitute would man that field, 40 to a side, wearing white or black tabards to distinguish themselves. This strange employment was the reason they risked the long, hard trudge to Salon Corbeau. Locke had already discovered that there were 2 large barracks behind Lady Selgeska's stadium, heavily guarded, where the poor were taken upon arrival in Salon Corbeau. There they were made to clean themselves up, and were given 2 simple meals a day for the duration of their stay, which could be indefinite. Each aspirant, as they were known, was assigned a number. 3 times per day, random drawings were held to select 2 teams of 40 for the coming Amusement War. The only rule of the war was that the living pieces had to be able to stand, move, and obey orders. Children of 8 or 9 were about the youngest taken. Those who refused to participate when their number was drawn, even once, were thrown out of Saljeska's demi-city immediately and barred from returning. Without supplies and preparation, being cast out onto the roads in this dry land could be a death sentence. The aspirants were marched into the arena by 2 dozen of Saljeska's guards, who were armed with curved shields and lacquered wooden sticks. They were robust men and women who moved with the easy assurance of hard experience. Even a general uprising of the aspirants would stand no chance against them. The guards lined the aspirants up in their starting positions on the board, 40 white pieces and 40 black pieces, with 16 squares separating each double-ranked army. At opposite ends of the stadium were 2 special gallery boxes, one draped in black silk curtains and the other in white. These boxes were reserved far in advance by a waiting list, much as patrons of a chance house would lay claim to billiards tables or private rooms at certain hours. Whoever reserved a box gained the right to absolute command of that colour for the duration of a war. That morning's white war mistress was a young Lashani Viscountess, whose retinue looked as nervous with the affair as she was enthusiastic. They appeared to be scribbling notes and consulting charts. The black war master was a middle-aged Iridani, with the well-fed, calculating look of a prosperous merchant. He had a young son and daughter with him in his gallery. Although the living pieces could be hung, by the agreement of both players, with special tabards that gave them unusual privileges or movement allowances, the rules of this particular amusement war seemed to be plain catch-the-duke with no variations. The controllers began calling orders, and the game slowly developed, with white and black pieces trudging nervously toward one another, very gradually closing the distance between the opposing forces. Locke found himself puzzled by the reaction of the stadium crowd. There were easily 60 or 70 spectators in the boxes, with twice as many servants, bodyguards, assistants, and messengers on hand, not to mention caterers in Saljeska's livery hurrying to and fro to serve their wants. Their buzz of eager anticipation seemed totally incongruous, given the plodding nature of the contest shaping up on the square. "What," Locke muttered to himself in Vajran, "is so damn fascinating?" Then the first piece was taken, and the demons came out to the arena floor. The white war mistress deliberately placed one of her pieces, a middle-aged man, in harm's way. More of her army lurked behind him in an obvious trap, but the black war master apparently decided it was a worthwhile exchange. Under the shouted orders of the black adjutant, a teenaged girl in black stepped from a diagonal square and touched the middle-aged man on the shoulder. He hung his head, and the appreciative clapping of the crowd was drowned out a moment later by a wild shrieking that arose from the far left side of Locke's view of the stadium. 6 men ran onto the arena floor from a side portal, dressed in elaborate leather costumes with black and orange fluting. Their faces were covered with grotesque flame-orange masks, trailing wild manes of black hair. They threw their arms in the air, screaming and hollering meaninglessly, and the crowd cheered back as they ran across the arena toward the cringing man in white. The demons seized him by the arms and by the hair. He was thrust, sobbing, to the side of the game board and exhibited to the crowd like a sacrificial animal. One of the demons, a man with a booming voice, pointed to the black war master and shouted, "Cry the default!"
"I want to cry it," said the little boy in the merchant's gallery.
"We agreed that your sister would go first. Theodora, name the default." The little girl peered down to the arena floor in concentration, then whispered up to her father. He cleared his throat and shouted, "She wants the guards to beat him with their clubs, on his legs." And so it was. The demons held the writhing, screaming man with his limbs spread, while 2 guards obligingly laid into him. The fall of their sticks echoed across the arena. They thoroughly bruised his thighs, shins, and calves until the chief demon waved his hands to clear them off. The audience applauded politely, though not with particular enthusiasm, noted Locke, and the demons hauled the quivering, bleeding man off the stadium floor. They came back soon enough. One of the whites removed a black on the next move. "Cry the default!" echoed once again across the arena.
"I'll sell the right for 5 solari, shouted the Lashani Viscountess. "First taker!"
"I'll pay it,"
cried an old man in the stands, dressed in layers of velvet and cloth of gold. The chief demon pointed up at him, and he beckoned to a frock-coated attendant standing just behind him. The attendant threw a purse down to one of Saljeska's guards, who carried it over to the white war mistress's side of the field and threw it into her gallery. The demons then hauled the young woman in black over for the old man's examination. After a moment of exaggerated contemplation, he shouted,
"Get rid of her dress!"
The young woman's black tabard and dirty cotton dress were ripped apart by the grasping hands of the demons. In seconds, she was naked. She seemed determined to give less of a demonstration than the man who'd gone before. She glared stonily up at the old man, be he minor lord or merchant prince, and said nothing.
"Is that all?" cried the chief demon. "Oh, no," said the old man. "Get rid of her hair, too!"
The crowd burst into applause and cheers at that, and the woman betrayed real fear for the first time. She had a thick mane of glossy black hair down to the small of her back, something to be proud of even among the penniless, perhaps all she had to be proud of in the world. The chief demon played to the crowd, hoisting a gleaming, crooked dagger over his head and howling with glee. The woman attempted to struggle against the 5 pairs of arms that held her, to no avail. Swiftly, painfully, the chief demon slashed at her long black locks. They fluttered down until the ground was thick with them, and the woman's scalp was covered with nothing but a chopped, irregular stubble. Trickles of blood ran down her face and neck as she was dragged, too numb for further struggle, out of the arena. So it went, as Locke watched in growing unease, as the pitiless sun crept across the sky and the shadows shortened. The living pieces moved on the gleaming hot squares without water and without relief, until they were taken from the board and subjected to a default of the opposing war master's choosing. It soon became apparent to Locke that the default could be virtually anything short of death. The demons would follow orders with frenzied enthusiasm, playing up each new injury or humiliation for the appreciative crowd. Gods, Locke realized, barely any of them are here for the game at all. They've only come to see the defaults. The rows of armored guards would dissuade all possibility of refusal or rebellion. Those pieces who refused to hurry along to their appointed places or dared to step off their squares without instructions were simply beaten until they obeyed. Obey they did, and the cruelty of the defaults did not wane as the game went on.
"Rotten fruit!"
the little boy in the black war master's box yelled, and so it was. An elderly woman with a white tabard was thrown against the stadium wall and pelted with apples, pears, and tomatoes by 4 of the demons. They knocked her off her feet and continued the barrage until the woman was a shuddering heap, curled up beneath her frail arms for protection, and great spatters of sour pulp and juice were dripping from the wall behind her. The white player's retaliation was swift. She took a stocky young man in black colours and for once reserved the choice of default to herself.
"We must keep our hostess stadium clean. Take him to the wall with the fruit stains," she shouted, "and let him clean it with his tongue."
The crowd broke into wild applause at that. The man on the arena floor was pushed up to the wall by the chief demon.
"Start licking, scum!"
His first efforts were half-hearted. Another demon produced a whip that ended in 7 knotted cords and lashed the man across the shoulders, knocking him into the wall hard enough to bloody his nose.
"Earn your fucking pay, worm!" screamed the demon, whipping him once again.
Haven't you ever had a lady tell you to get down and use your tongue before?
The man ran his tongue desperately up and down the wall, gagging every few seconds, which would bring another crack of the demon's whip. The man was a bleeding, retching, nervous wreck by the time he was finally hauled from the arena floor. So it went, all morning long. Gods, why do they bear it? Why do they take this? Locke stood in the free gallery alone, staring out at the wealthy and powerful, at their guards and servants, and at the thinning ranks of the living pieces in the game beneath them. He brooded, sweating in his heavy black garments. Here were the richest and freest people in the Therin world, those with positions and money but no political duties to constrict them, gathered together to do what law and custom forbade beyond Salgeska's private fiefdom, to humiliate and brutalize their lessers however they saw fit for their own gleeful amusement. The arena and the amusement war itself were obviously just frames, means to an end. There was no order to it, no justice. Gladiators and prisoners fighting before a crowd were there for a reason, risking their lives for glory or paying the price for having been caught. Men and women hung from a gibbets because the crooked warden had only so much help to give to the foolish, the slow, and the unlucky. But this was wanton. Locke felt his anger growing like a canker in his guts. They had no idea who he was or what he was really capable of. No idea what the Thorn of Camor could do to them, unleashed on Salon Corbeau, with Jean to aid him. Given months to plan and observe, the gentleman bastards could take the place apart, find ways to cheat the amusement war, surely. Rob the participants, rob the Lady Salgeska, embarrass and humiliate the bastards, blacken the demi-city's reputation so thoroughly that nobody would ever want to visit again. But...
Crooked Warden, Locke whispered. Why now? Why show me this now?
Jean was waiting for him back in Tal Varrar, and they were already neck deep in a game that had taken a year to put together. Jean didn't know anything about what really went on at Salon Corbeau. He would be expecting Locke to return in short order with a set of chairs, so the two of them could carry on with the plan they'd agreed to, a plan that was already desperately delicate.
"Gods damn it," said Locke. "Gods damn it all to hell."
5. Camor, years before, the wet, seeping mists enclosed Locke and Father Chains in curtains of midnight grey as the old man led the boy back home from his first meeting with Capo Vencarlo Barsavi. Locke, drunk and sweat-soaked, clung to the back of his gentled goat for dear life.
"You don't belong to Barsavi," Chains said. "He's good enough for what he is, a good ally to have on your side, and a man that you must appear to obey at all times. But he certainly doesn't own you. In the end, neither do I."
"So I don't have to..."
"Obey the secret peace, be a good little peasant. Only for pretend, Locke. Only to keep the wolves from the door. Unless your eyes and ears have been stitched shut with rawhide these past 2 days, by now you must have realized that I intend you and Carlo and Galdo and Sabatha to be nothing less," Chains confided through a feral grin, "than a fucking ballista bolt right through the heart of Vencarlo's precious secret peace."
Locke collected his thoughts for several moments. "Why?"
"Heh. It's complicated. It has to do with what I am and what I hope you'll someday be. A priest in the sworn service of the Crooked Warden."
"Is the Kappa doing something wrong?"
"Well," said Chains, "well, lad, now there's a question. Is he doing right by the right people? Gods, yes. The secret peace tames the city watch, calms everyone down, gets less of us hung.
Still, every priesthood has what we call mandates, laws handed down by the gods themselves to those who serve them. In most temples, these are complex, messy, annoying things. In the priesthood of the benefactor, things are easy. We only have two. The first one is thieves prosper. Simple as that. We're ordered to aid one another, hide one another, make peace whenever possible, and see to it that our kind flourishes, by hook or by crook. Barsavi's got that mandate covered, never doubt that. But the second mandate, said Chains, lowering his voice and glancing around into the fog to make doubly sure that they were not overheard, is this. The rich remember.
Remember what?
That they're not invincible, that locks can be picked and treasures can be stolen. Nara, mistress of ubiquitous maladies, may her hand be stayed, sends disease among men so that men will never forget that they are not gods. We're sort of like that, for the rich and powerful. We're the stone in their shoe, the thorn in their side, a little bit of reciprocity this side of divine judgment. That's our second mandate, and it's as important as the first.
And the secret peace protects the nobles, and so you don't like it?
It's not that I don't like it. Chains mulled his next few words over before he let them out. Barsavi's not a priest of the 13th. He's not sworn to the mandates like I am. He's got to be practical. And while I can accept that, I can't just let it go. It's my divine duty to see that the blue bloods with their pretty titles get a little bit of what life hands the rest of us as a matter of routine. A nice sharp jab in the ass every now and again.
And Barsavi doesn't need to know about this?
Bleeding shits, no. As I see it, if Barsavi takes care of thieves prosper, and I look after the rich remember, this'll be one holy, holy city in the eyes of the crooked warden.
6. Why do they bear it? I know they get paid, but the defaults, gods, holy marrows, why do they come here and put up with it? Humiliated, beaten, stoned, befouled? To what end?
Locke paced agitatedly around the Beaumondaine family's workshop, clenching and unclenching his fists. It was the afternoon of his fourth day in Salon Corbeau.
As you said, they get paid, Master Fairwhite.
Loris Beaumondaine rested one hand gently on the back of the half-finished chair Locke had come in to see. With the other she stroked poor motionless Lively, tucked away inside a pocket of her apron.
If you're selected for a game, you get a copper centira. If you're given a default, you get a silver volani. There's also a random drawing. One person per war, 1 in 80, gets a gold solari.
They must be desperate, said Locke.
Farms fail, businesses fail, tenant lands get repossessed, plagues knock all the money and health out of cities. When they've got nowhere else to come, they come here. There's a roof to sleep under, meals, hope of gold or silver. All you have to do is go out there often enough and amuse them.
It's perverse, it's infamous.
You have a soft heart for what you're spending on just 4 chairs, Master Fairwhite.
Loris looked down and wrung her hands together.
Forgive me, I spoke well out of turn.
Speak as you will. I am not a rich man, Loris. I am just my master's servant. But even he... We're frugal people, damn it. Frugal and fair. We might be eccentric, but we're not cruel.
I've seen nobles from the marrows at the amusement war many times, Master Fairwhite.
We're not nobles. We're merchants. Merchants of Emberlane. I can't speak for our nobles, and often don't want to. Look, I've seen many cities.
I know how people live. I've seen gladiatorial fights, executions, misery and poverty and desperation, but I've never seen anything like that. The faces of those spectators, the way they watched and cheered, like jackals, like crows, like something so very wrong.
There are no laws here but Lady Selgeska's laws, said Loris. Here they can behave however they choose. At the amusement war they can do exactly what they want to do to the poor folk and the simple folk. Things forbidden elsewhere. All you're seeing is what they look like when they stop pretending they give a damn about anything. Where do you think Lively came from? I saw a noblewoman having kittens gentled so her sons could torture them with knives. Because they were bored at tea. So welcome to Salon Corbeau, Master Fairwhite. I'm sorry it's not the paradise it looks like from a distance. Does our work on the chairs meet with your approval?
Yes, said Locke slowly. Yes, I suppose it does.
If I were to presume to give you advice, said Loris, I'd suggest that you stay away from the amusement war for the rest of your stay. Do what the rest of us here do. Ignore it. Paint a great cloud of fog over it in your mind's eye and pretend that it's not there.
As you say, Madame Beaumondaine, Locke sighed. I might just do so. 7. But Locke could not stay away. Morning, afternoon, and evening, he found himself in the public gallery, standing alone, eating and drinking nothing. He saw crowd after crowd, war after war, humiliation after humiliation. The demons made gruesome mistakes on several occasions. Beatings and stranglings got out of control. Those aspirants who were accidentally roughed up beyond hope of recovery had their skulls crushed on the spot, to the polite applause of the crowd. It would not do to be unmerciful. Crooked warden, Locke muttered to himself the first time it happened. They don't even have a priest, not a single one. He realized dimly what he was doing to himself. He felt the stirring within, as though his conscience were a deep, still lake with a beast struggling to rise to its surface. Each brutal humiliation, each painful default, excitedly decreed by some spoiled noble child, while their parents laughed in appreciation, gave strength to that beast as it beat itself against his better judgment, his cold calculation, his willingness to stick to the plan. He was trying to make himself angry enough to give in. The Thorn of Camor had been a mask he'd half-heartedly worn as a game. Now it was almost a separate entity, a hungry thing, an increasingly insistent ghost prying at his resolve to stand up for the mandate of his faith. Let me out, it whispered. Let me out. The rich must remember. By the gods, I can make damn sure they never forget. I hope you'll pardon my intrusion if I observe that you don't seem to be enjoying yourself. Locke was snapped out of his brooding by the appearance of another man in the free gallery. The stranger was tanned and fit-looking, perhaps 5 or 6 years older than Locke, with brown curls down to his collar and a precisely trimmed goatee. His long velvet coat was lined with cloth of silver, and he held a gold-topped cane behind his back with both hands. But forgive me. Fernand Genrusa, Peer of the Third of Lachaine. Peer of the Third Order, a baron, a purchased Lachani patent of nobility, just as Locke and Jean had toyed with possibly acquiring. Locke bent slightly at the waist and inclined his head.
Mordavi Fairwhite, my lord, of Emberlane.
A merchant, then. You must be doing well for yourself, Master Fairwhite, to take your leisure here. So what's behind your long face? What makes you think I'm displeased? You stand here alone, taking no refreshment, and you watch each new war with such an expression on your face, as though someone was slipping hot coals into your breech clout. I've seen you several times from my own gallery. Are you losing money?
I might be able to share some insights I've cultivated on how to best place wagers at the amusement war.
I have no wagers outstanding, my lord. I am merely unable to stop watching.
Curious, yet it does not please you.
No.
Locke turned slightly toward Baron Genrusa and swallowed nervously. Etiquette demanded that a lowborn like Mordavi Fairwhite, and a Vadran at that, should defer even to a banknote baron like Genrusa and offer no unpleasant conversation, but Genrusa seemed to be inviting explanation. Locke wondered how much he might get away with.
Have you ever seen a carriage accident, my lord, or a man run over by a team of horses, seen the blood and wreckage, and been completely unable to take your eyes off the spectacle?
I can't say that I have.
There I would beg to differ. You have a private gallery to see it 3 times a day if you wish, my lord.
Ah, so you find the amusement war, what, undecorous?
Cruel, my lord Genrusa, most uncommonly cruel.
Cruel? Compared to what? War? Times of plague? Have you ever seen Camor, by chance? Now there's a basis for comparison that might have you thinking more soundly, Master Fairwhite.
Even in Camor, said Locke, I don't believe anyone is allowed to beat old women in broad daylight on a whim, or tear their clothes off, stone them, rape them, slash their hair off, splash them with alchemical caustics. It's like children tearing off an insect's wings, so they might watch and laugh.
Who forced them to come here, Fairwhite? Who put a sword to their backs and made them march all the way to Salon Corbeau along those hot, empty roads? That pilgrimage takes days from anywhere worthy of note.
What choice do they have, my lord? They're only here because they're desperate, because they could not sustain themselves where they were. Farms fail, businesses fail. It's desperation is all. They cannot simply decide not to eat.
Farms fail, businesses fail, ships sink, empires fall.
Genrusa brought his cane out from behind his back and punctuated his statements by gesturing at Locke with the gold head.
That's life under the gods, by the will of the gods. Perhaps if they'd prayed harder, or saved more, or been less thoughtless with what they had, they wouldn't need to come crawling here for Salgeska's charity. Seems only fair that she should require most of them to earn it.
Charity?
They have a roof over their heads, food to eat, and the chance of money. Those that earn the gold prizes seem to have no trouble taking their coin and leaving.
1 in 80 wins a solari, my lord. No doubt more money than they've ever seen at once in their lives. And for the other 79, that gold is just a promise, holding them here day after day, week after week, default after default. And those that die because the demons get out of hand, what good is gold or the promise of gold to them? Anywhere else, it would be plain murder.
It's Azaguia that takes them from the arena floor, not you or I or anyone mortal, Fairwhite.
Genrusa's brows were furrowed and his cheeks were reddening.
And yes, anywhere else, it might be plain murder. But this is Salon Corbeau, and they're here of their own free will, as are you and I. They could simply choose not to come.
And starve and die elsewhere.
Please. I have seen the world, Master Fairwhite. I might recommend it to you for perspective. Certainly some of them must be down on their luck, but I wager you'd find that most of them are just hungry for gold, hoping for an easy break. Look out at those on the arena floor now. Quite a few young and healthy ones, aren't there?
Who else might be expected to make the journey here on foot without extraordinary luck, my lord Genrusa?
I can see there's no talking sense to sentiment, Master Fairwhite. I'd thought you coin-kissers from Emberlane were a harder lot than this.
Hard, perhaps, but not vulgar. Now mind yourself, Master Fairwhite. I wanted a word because I was genuinely curious about your disposition. I think I can see now what it stems from. A bit of advice. Salon Corbeau might not be the healthiest place to harbour your sort of resentment. My business here will be shortly concluded. All for the better, then. But perhaps your business at the amusement war might be curtailed even sooner. I'm not the only one who's taken an interest in you. Lady Salgeska's guards are sensitive about discontent, above the arena floor as well as on it. I could leave you penniless and sobbing, whispered the voice in Locke's head. I could have you pawning your piss buckets to keep your creditors from slitting your throat. Forgive me, my lord, I will take what you say most seriously, muttered Locke. I doubt that I shall trouble anyone here again. 8. On the morning of Locke's ninth day in Salon Corbeau, the Beaumondaines were finished with his chairs. They look magnificent, said Locke, running his fingers lightly over the lacquered wood and padded leather. Very fine as I had reason to hope. And the additional features?
Built to your specifications, Master Fairwhite. Exactly to your specifications.
Loris stood beside her father in the Beaumondaine workshop while 10-year-old Parnella was struggling to brew tea over an alchemical hearthstone at a corner table covered in unidentifiable tools and half-empty jars of woodworking oils. Locke made a mental note to smell any tea offered to him very carefully before drinking. You have outdone yourselves, all of you.
We were financially inspired, Master Fairwhite, said the elder Beaumondaine. I like building weird things, Parnella added from the corner.
Yes, I suppose these would qualify. Locke stared at his suite of four matching chairs and sighed in mingled relief and aggravation. Well, then, if you'd be so kind as to ready them for transport, I shall hire two carriages and take my leave this afternoon.
In that much hurry to leave?
I hope you'll forgive me if I say that every unnecessary moment I spend in this place weighs on me. Salon Corbeau and I do not agree. Locke removed a leather purse from his coat pocket and tossed it to Master Beaumondaine. An additional 20 solari. For your silence, and for these chairs to never have existed. Is this clear?
I'm sure we can accommodate your request. I must say your generosity is...
A subject that needs no further discussion. Humour me now. I'll be gone soon enough. So that's all, said the voice in Locke's head. Stick to the plan. Leave this all behind and do nothing and return to Tal Vahrar with my tail between my legs. While he and Jean enriched themselves at Requin's expense and cheated their way up the luxurious floors of the Sinspire, on the stone floor of Lady Salgeska's arena the defaults would go on, and the faces of the spectators would be the same day after day. Children tearing the wings from insects to laugh at how they flailed and bled, and stepping on one every now and again. Thieves prosper, muttered Locke under his breath. He tightened his neckcloths and prepared to go summon his carriages, feeling sick to his stomach.